Have you ever had a lucky day? One of those days where everything went right. All the details just fell into place. I mean, from the moment your feet hit the floor to the moment your head hits the pillow at night, nothing went wrong. You may have felt like singing, "Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I've got a beautiful feeling. Everything's going my way." Ask any Chicago Cubs fan right now, and they'll probably tell you that's what they've been feeling lately. Then again, there are those other days, right? You know, the moment your feet hit the floor and you step on one of your child's toys, or in our case, a piece of our dog's food, which is about the consistency of a rock. You pour coffee on your cereal instead of milk. You're running late and you go outside and you find you got a flat tire. Or two. It's one of those days you just want to go back to bed, right? Now, what do we say about those days? One day we call lucky. We'll tell someone having a day like that, "You need to go buy a lottery ticket. This is your lucky day." And the other day we'll call unlucky. Some call it chance. Some call it fate. Some chalk it up to karma. They shrug their shoulders and they say, "What a coincidence." You know, when it comes to that, I'm with Gibbs from NCIS. Rule 39, there's no such thing as a coincidence. I've lived enough life to know that things don't just happen. What people call coincidence, the Bible calls providence. And no, I'm not talking about the capital of Rhode Island. Providence is seen in Proverbs 16, verse 9. "In his heart a man plans his course, but the Lord determines his steps." In Proverbs 19, 21, "Many are the plans in a man's heart, but it is the Lord's purpose that prevails." It is also seen in the words of Joseph. In Genesis 50, verse 20, this is when he confronts his brothers, the very ones who years ago had sold him into slavery. And now he holds the power to save their lives or end them. And he says, "God turned into good what you meant for evil." That's providence. Now, by providence, I'm not suggesting that God takes away our ability to choose. He's given everyone freedom of choice. The problem with this particular theological debate is that we think of it in terms of either or. Either God is sovereign and he does everything and determines everything, or man has the freedom to choose. That's a wrong premise. We don't have to choose between the two, because in fact, both are true. You find passages in the New Testament, twice in Ephesians 1, once in Romans 8:29, where Paul uses the word predestined. At which point a lot of people go, "Ooh, predestination, that's spooky." No, it's not. Some people don't like the idea of predestination because it sounds like God's taken away my freedom of choice. No, he's not. What it means is this. While you have the freedom to choose, God controls the consequences. Think about that. You have choices that you make every day. Some of them are rather insignificant. What you're going to wear, what you're going to eat for breakfast. Others are more substantial. What we do, what we say. But do you ever notice that when you speak, once those words pass out of your mouth, you can't control what they do? Once you've done something, you can't control how other people react. You can't control the consequences of your choices. But God can, and he does. And sometimes he works through what might seem to be ordinary, everyday, insignificant things, but he brings them together in such a way that his perfect plan fits. And that's what we see really throughout the book of Esther, but especially in our passage this morning. We see God's hand at work. And God can use even the worst decisions and choices to bring about His goodwill. I like how R.C. Sproul puts it. God's sovereign providence works out His will through the actions of human wills without violating the freedom of those human wills. God doesn't make anybody do anything. And by the way, neither does the devil. How many remember the old Flip Wilson show? And Geraldine. What was her favorite saying?
The devil made me do it.
No, he didn't. Never. Now, the devil can suggest, he can tempt, he can put it out there and it really looks good, but he don't make us do nothing. We do that ourselves. Don't blame God, don't blame the devil for the choices we make. I hear a lot of people complaining right now about the upcoming presidential election. Oh, how could we have these two people? Neither one of them we like. Guess what, folks? They were elected. They were put there by our choice. Now you say, well, I didn't vote for him. Yeah, but I'm talking the whole picture of our country. Don't blame God. Don't blame the devil. Look in a mirror. Now that brings us to Esther. It's been called arguably the most ironically comic event in all the Bible. One Jewish scholar says it's one of the funniest anywhere in Scripture. Stanley Collins writes, "Do you think God has a sense of humor? I hope you do, for we are now going to see God demonstrate His sovereignty in such a way as to produce the best laughs of all time, yet at the same time to solemnly intervene and save His people." And it's okay to smile and laugh in church. I know some of you may have been brought up and, you know, think everybody's serious and solemn. No, God has a sense of humor. We're going to see that today. First, I want to consider Haman's haughty demeanor. Proverbs 16:18 says, "Pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall." Proverbs 11:2 similarly teaches, "When pride comes, there comes disgrace, but with humility comes wisdom." And certainly we see both of these in the case of Haman. One commentator puts it, "If there was ever a picture of pride going before a fall, it's Haman." Now, let's just review a little bit, in case you weren't here last week, to set the stage for what's happening here. At the beginning of chapter 5 in Esther, the queen appears before the king uninvited. Now, that wasn't just a social faux pas, that was a capital crime. You did not appear before the king uninvited, or you lost your head. The only exception was if the king would extend his scepter and allow you to approach. Well, Esther takes her life in her hands and appears before the king. And the king extends the scepter and allows Esther to come and approach him. And he says, "What is it, Esther? Anything you want up to half the kingdom, you can have it." And Esther says, "I would like you and Haman to attend a lunch I'm preparing for today." King probably scratched his beard and thought, "What in the world is this? I mean, she risks her life for that?" But that's what she wants. "Go get Haman, we're going to lunch." They did like to eat back then. And so Esther has the king and Haman, they have a good meal. They're enjoying themselves. They get to the end of the meal, and the king says, "Okay, Esther, what is so important? Whatever it is, you can ask. It's okay." And Esther says, "If it pleases the king, come tomorrow to lunch I want to prepare for you and Haman." By now, the king's head has got to be about to explode. Seriously? That's what you risked your life for? But again, he says, "Okay, we'll do it." And now we get to verse 9. And we see Haman's haughty demeanor in three areas. The first is in his arrogance. Look at verse 9. Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. Chuck Swindoll observes, he walks out of the palace thinking, boy, am I ever in clover. I have no idea what that means, but that's what he wrote. I just had a private dinner and audience with the king and the queen. What an honor. My star is on the rise. The sky's the limit. It was the ultimate opportunity to drop names. Could you imagine Haman the next day at the office? Oh, yeah, when I was having dinner with the king and the queen, did I mention that nobody else was there? Just me. And I was invited back tomorrow, too. It'd be enough to make you sick, wouldn't it? So you see Haman leaving the palace, bursting with pride and with ego. Verses 10 and 11 say that he calls together his friends and his wife Zeresh. The word here for friends can mean advisors or wise men. One commentator cracked, Haman had to summon professional friends to hear his bragging. And brag he does. He boasts about his wealth. He boasts about his sons. We learn later he had 10. He boasts about all of the appointments that the king had given to him and his rise in the government. All of which, by the way, everybody in attendance already knew. Don't you find it just a little bit amusing that Haman is bragging about how many sons he has to his wife? Don't you think she would know? I mean, she was there, right? And they knew all this stuff because Haman couldn't shut up about it. He was always bragging about what he had done and what he had. See, back then, the number of sons you had was cause for bragging rights. They even had a contest. The king would give an award to whoever had the most sons. And so Haman is just piling it on. He's just going on and on and on. Brag, brag, brag. Me, me, me. Can you imagine having to sit and listen to this blowhard? I mean, they couldn't really object because, you know, he is wearing the king's ring on his finger. And at, you know, any moment, he could probably have you killed. So you have to sit there and say, oh, that's great, Haman. But in their mind, they're rolling their eyes saying, man, how can we get out of this? How long is this guy going to go on? The Greeks feared a vice that they called hubris. It's that pompous arrogance and self-esteem that go before a fall. And you look that up in a dictionary, and there's Haman's picture. I mean, this is a walking example of arrogance. Going around bragging about who he knows and all the things that he has and the things that have been done to him. And what it does is it clouds his judgment. We're going to see that the reason why pride goes before a fall is because it blinds you to good sense. And there are times when Haman should have kept his mouth shut, and he doesn't. His arrogance is evident. Haman's haughty demeanor is also seen in his assumptions. Look at verse 12. And that's not all, Haman added. I'm the only person, Queen Esther, invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave. And she's invited me along with the king to go tomorrow as well. He's saying, in effect, apart from the king, the queen wouldn't let anybody else come to her dinner but me. And just between you and me, I'm not so sure she was excited about the king being there either. He is so egocentric. He has such a high opinion of himself. He's thinking that, oh, the queen must really like me a lot because I'm the only person she's inviting. Now, the funny part is, we know why she invited him, right? She wants him to be there at that moment when she can point a finger at his face and say, he's the man. That she can tell her husband, the king, this man is trying to kill me and all of my family. But Haman doesn't know that. He assumes that he's in Esther's good graces. And so it just puffs him up a little bit more. You know, Haman's behavior could serve as a textbook illustration of foolishness. Proverbs 22:27, verse 2 reads, May another praise you and not your own mouth, a stranger and not your own lips. The implication is that when you brag on yourself, you just show yourself for the fool you really are. And that was what Haman was all about. Then finally, Haman's haughty demeanor is seen in his anger. Now for this, we have to back up a couple of verses. Verses 9 and 10, coming out of the palace on his way home, when Haman saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, he restrained himself and went home. You know, one thing spoiled Haman's perfect day. He had everything going for him, but one person ruined it all because Mordecai wouldn't show him the respect that Haman thought he deserved. And it angered him. It said he was filled with rage. He comes home and says in verse 13, all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. After bragging about everything that he's got, he says it doesn't mean a thing because one person is ruining it for me. Isn't it amazing how a person can have what, you know, seems everything to make them happy, and yet one little thing can take away all their enjoyment? Here it was Haman's pride that was hurt to think that someone dared not show him respect. You almost think Haman's like, you know, Rodney Dangerfield. Don't get no respect, right? And that ruined his whole day. Now Zeresh, Haman's wife, had heard all she could take. I could just imagine you, if you could see this interchange going on. Zeresh is sitting back and saying, oh, would you quit sniveling? Quit your whining. You're bragging about having all this power in the kingdom. Why don't you do something about it? You want to get rid of this Mordecai? What? Go build a gallows. Make it 75 feet high so everybody can see it. And in the morning, go ask the king and he'll give you the permission. You can hang him on it. Now remember, gallows is not like in the Old West where, you know, they had the rope and they'd hang a criminal by it. This was just a big old pole they would impale somebody on, but they'd leave their body out so everybody could see it, hoping they would learn a lesson. Zeresh says, look, Haman, quit whining and do something. And Haman says, oh, great idea. I'll go and build this thing. 75 feet's kind of outlandish. I mean, really, if it was 75 feet high, who could get Mordecai's body up there to begin with? And if it was hanging up that high, would anybody really know who it was? I think it was probably exaggeration. You know how we do that. If I've told you once, I've told you a million times. Oh, whatever. But we overstate it, right? If this had been today, you know, build it 100 feet tall. It's just a word we get out there to get the point across. At any rate, notice how she ends her suggestion. Then go merrily to the dinner. That'll make you happy, Haman. And according to verse 14, it worked. This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the gallows built. Joyce Baldwin concludes, the connection between murder and merriment and Haman's pleasure is even more sinister than the gallows he's building. The fact that that would make him so happy, it just tells you something about this guy, doesn't it? Now, by the way, to this day, when the Jews read the book of Esther, and they do it every year at Purim, we'll get to that holiday later in the book, every time Haman's name is mentioned, the audience boos and hisses. You kind of get the idea why when you see this guy's character. His hatred is just consuming him to the point that only the death of his enemy could satisfy. That was his haughty demeanor. But then everything changes when you change into chapter 6. I often say the Bible was not written with chapter and verse divisions, and there are some times when whoever did it blew it, but this was a good one. Definitely there is a change when you get to chapter 6, verse 1. In fact, it's a total reversal. The whole book turns on this passage. Everything is looking bad for Esther and Mordecai and the Jews up to this point, and from this point on, everything turns and things begin to look hopeful. But for Haman, we see a humiliating downfall. Now, it all begins very innocently enough. There's a case of royal insomnia. Verse 1 says, that night the king could not sleep. Now, we've all had that, haven't we? I just had it last night. Woke up at 2:30 in the morning and could not go back to sleep. It happens sometimes. Well, the king couldn't sleep, and so we're told he ordered the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. Now, my guess is when you hear the mention of Chronicles, you're thinking 1st and 2nd Chronicles in the Old Testament. And those of you that have read through the Old Testament think that would put anybody to sleep. Well, that's not quite exactly what the Chronicles are here. Here, that is the record of everything that had happened during his reign. Now, I'm getting the same impression, boring. And maybe that's why he wanted it. Maybe he thought, somebody starts reading this stuff and he'll just, go to sleep. I think there might be another suggestion, though. Maybe Xerxes couldn't sleep because there was something nagging at him. Something was bothering him to the point that he couldn't sleep. And I'm thinking it might be Esther's request. See, he's got to be thinking, why would she risk her life to invite me to dinner twice? It just makes no sense. And why bring Haman along? He's racking his brain. He's probably thinking, did I forget our anniversary? Maybe it was her birthday. There's got to be something I'm missing here. So maybe that's why he wanted the annals brought out to be read, so that he could discover what it is that he's missing. And you find out that he did. Now, before we get there, I think it's a good place to point out the potential benefits to those times we can't fall asleep. I read something this last week in the Senior's Devotional Bible. Yes, I have a Senior's Devotional Bible. Barbara Dean wrote a little devotional. She calls it God's Night School. And I think she gives some good insight. More than half of all people over 65 complain about insomnia, but few recognize it as a spiritual opportunity. Being alone with God in the middle of the night, when all the daytime distractions are far away, can give us the opportunity to do some of the important spiritual work for later years. It may be the cleansing of unconfessed sins of the past. It may be forgiving others and asking forgiveness for ourselves, or bringing to mind those with whom we need to seek reconciliation and the healing of friendships. It may be learning simply to be with God, bathing ourselves in the light of His love. There's much more to prayer than most of us have ever dreamed possible, and now we have great volumes of time to learn it. And I think that is true. Next time you find yourself having difficulty going to sleep, use that for prayer. One of two things will happen. The devil will either come along and put you to sleep, and then you're asleep, or you're going to really have time to accomplish things for God. It can improve your own spiritual walk with Him. You can be praying for others. Ask the Lord to bring somebody to your mind that needs prayer. Utilize that time. Well, at any rate, Mordecai has these records read, and in it he finds out, is reminded actually, that Mordecai had saved his life. Now, this was probably 5 years before. Remember back in chapter 2, Mordecai overheard a plot? A couple of the bodyguards were going to assassinate Xerxes, and he heard about it. He warned Esther, who warned the king. The two men were arrested, and they were put to death. Problem was, Mordecai was never honored for that. And that's a big deal in the Persian culture of the day. In fact, it would be a great disgrace for the king if word got out that someone had saved his life and he didn't do anything to honor him. Now, as soon as he hears about this and puts two and two together, the wheels start turning. He begins to imagine what might be done to reward this man for his great deed. And if you know anything about Xerxes from the book of Esther, he doesn't do anything without advice. I wonder sometimes if the man could make up his own mind. He always has to have somebody telling him what to do. So he says, is there anybody out in the court, in the courtyard, somebody I can talk to? And they said, well, by the way, you know, just so happens, Haman is out there. Now, we're not told exactly what time of day this is. I don't know if it's the middle of the night, or maybe it's very early in the morning, just as, you know, the sun is coming up. But here's Haman. Now, why is Haman there? Well, Haman couldn't sleep either. Not for the same reason. He's so excited about getting this gallows built so that he can kill Mordecai and finally get this guy out of his life. He can't wait to ask the king for Mordecai's head. He wants to be first in line, so he goes early in the morning, and there he is. So the king has told Haman is there. He says, great, bring him in. So they bring Haman in, and he's probably thinking, ah, this is it. This is my chance. Maybe he glanced out the window at that gallows being built, saying, just a minute, gallows, somebody will be on you soon. You can just imagine him strutting like a peacock going into the king. Yeah, I can't help but think of that cartoon figure, Wile E. Coyote. You know who I'm talking about? Always trying to catch that roadrunner. And he can't do it the simple way. He's got to plan this elaborate trap, right? All this, you know, big old plans laid out. He always orders stuff from Acme. I guess that was the old version of Amazon back then. But everything had Acme written on it, right? When I read this, I could just see Acme printed on Haman's gallows. Because you know what's going to happen. The same thing happens to the coyote. He gets caught in his own trap. And there goes Haman, strutting right in, thinking everything's going his way. Can you appreciate the irony of the scene? I mean, here's two men, neither of whom can sleep, both have the same man on their minds, and yet for completely different reasons. Yet we sit back and we watch these two figures as their lives are about to intersect, and we know what's coming, but they have no clue. So without even waiting to say good morning or finding out what he wanted, the king says to Haman, what should be done for the man the king delights to honor? And for the first time in a while, Mordecai just totally escapes Haman's mind. All he can think of is me. I mean, who else is the king going to want to honor? It's not enough that he's given me the signet ring. Maybe he wants to appoint me successor to the throne. Because if you'll notice, what Haman suggests, and you got to know he's got himself in mind, right? He says to the king, bring out a royal robe and let them put that on me. I mean the guy you want to honor. Bring out a royal horse and let the guy that you want to honor ride it. Have one of your other nobles go before him, lead the horse through town saying, this is the man that the king is honoring. And he's thinking about himself. He can feel himself on that horse with those robes, hearing his praises being announced. It's all about him. And then the king says, what a great idea. Go find Mordecai and do exactly what you say. Don't let one part of it be lost. Could you imagine Haman's face at that moment? I mean, you talk about a Kodak moment. Jaw, boom, on the floor. I figure he either turned really, really red because he was so mad, or he turned ashen white because he couldn't breathe. he just dumbstruck. Probably the only time you ever see Haman speechless is right now. But he has no choice. He has to do it. And so Haman got the robe and the horse. He robed Mordecai, led him on horseback through the city streets, proclaiming before him, "This is what is done to the man the king delights to honor." Just try to imagine how he would have said it. I think it probably went something like this. "This is what how the king honors a man he wants to honor." Or gritting his teeth. It would have been like gravel in his mouth to say these words. And not only is it bad enough that it's not him on the horse, but it's Mordecai. It's the very man he wanted to ask the king for his head. Now he's got to honor him. Now on the other side of the equation is Mordecai. He was the only one of the three that got any sleep the night before, because he had no idea what was going on. I'm sure he must have got a knock at the door early in the morning. He looks out his little peephole and there's Haman. He probably thought, "You've got to be kidding me. This is the worst day of my life. I'll go back to bed." No, he opened the door. And I'm sure he must have been dumbstruck as well that he was being honored in this way. He'd probably given up any hope that he would ever receive any credit or acclamation for what he had done 5 years ago. But here it is. And isn't it interesting? We don't see Mordecai saying anything as he's riding through town. He's not whispering, "Say it a little louder. Eat your heart out, Haman." Yeah, that would have been our temptation, right? You just got to stick it in there. But no. In fact, we're told that after it was all done, he just went back to his place at the king's gate. He went back to his job. Didn't let it go to his head. Applause doesn't change truly humble people. Because that's not what they're after. That's why God can honor humility. Now, verse 12 says, Haman rushes home. His head is covered with grief. Oh, horrible, horrible. Before he called his wife and friends together to brag, now he's calling them together to whine. And he tells them all that happened. In verse 13, his advisors and his wife Zeresh said, "Since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin." Which being interpreted means, you're dead meat. You're toast, Haman. You cannot fight against God. So they must not have understood that Mordecai was a Jew. And they had a whole different outlook on the Jews. And I don't know where they got it from, but it's pretty good theology. You don't go up against God's people. You're fighting a losing battle. This isn't your lucky day after all. The Persians were very superstitious. They saw this as a bad omen for Haman. And then you read the ominous words in verse 14. While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman away to the banquet Esther had prepared. That invitation that he was so proud of hours earlier is now his dreaded final meal. And you can just sense the tension building as he's being led away. So what do we make of this story for our own lives? For one thing, Haman teaches us that pride really does go before the fall. It's not just one of those sayings that we throw out there. It's true. And haven't you seen it in your own life? Somebody that's just so arrogant, they're just always bragging and just makes you sick. And pretty soon, it's splat. And it takes everything you can not to chuckle, right? Got what was coming. Mordecai didn't do that. He just let God take care of things. We need to heed James 4:10. Humble yourselves before the Lord and he will lift you up. Much better to be raised up by God than to raise ourselves up only to be dropped back down. Second, we see that in the end, God will right every wrong. It's often been said that God's delays are not God's denials. We pray for something and we think God's saying no. He's actually just saying wait. Mordecai had to wait 5 years to be rewarded for sticking his neck out and saving the life of the king. You may have to wait for that promotion. You might have to wait to be honored. You might need to wait for that wrong done against you to be righted. But I'm telling you today, it will be done. And it will be done at just the right time. God is never in a hurry. But he's never late. His timing is always perfect. And finally, we learn there's no such thing as coincidence. What appears to be timely coincidences are in fact evidences of God's providence. The king's inability to sleep, his requesting the reading of the Chronicles, the fact they just happened to read the chronicle of Mordecai's heroic deed. All of these things coming together. Haman's haste to get Mordecai's head so he shows up early in the morning and is the one who actually plans Mordecai's honor. They all seem like circumstances and coincidences. They're not. They're all God working in what seems to be incidental, trivial things to work out his will. From a Christian perspective, we see that these coincidences is really God's providence at work. From a human perspective, we think life's full of accidents. From a biblical perspective, we see life is full of appointments, divine appointments that God works out in his own way. As the master author of human history, God weaves together the stories of our lives. And he surprises us with joy, usually at times we least expect it. Wait on the Lord. And when you have those days that everything just seems to be a coincidence, maybe it's working against you, maybe it's working for you, realize this is God at work in my life. And no matter what it seems to be at the moment, in the end, we know God will work out his perfect plan for us. Coincidence or providence? Our answer depends on whether we're looking with the eyes of faith or if we're just viewing things by sight. Warren Wiersbe writes, "To walk by faith is to view earth from heaven's point of view. To walk by sight is to view heaven from earth's point of view." What are we going to choose? How will we view things in our lives? Will we see God at work, or will we call it just chance? When we see God at work, everything has meaning.